From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan responded today to the new scoring of the American Health Care Act, the Republican plan to replace the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. The CBO says the ACHA, which narrowly passed in the House, would leave 23 million more people uninsured in a decade than Obamacare. 14 million people would be uninsured next year. Ryan stood by the bill.
Not only is this an unstable individual insurance market, we have a collapsing individual insurance market, and that is why this is a rescue mission.
Let's bring in Allison Kojak, NPR health policy correspondent. Hi, Allison.
Hi, Robin.
And first to that claim, is the insurance market collapsing? Yesterday we saw Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Kansas City, that area's top insurer, say it would exit the Affordable Care Exchange next year. That probably feels a little collapsing in that area, but is the market collapsing?
Well, I think there definitely is instability in the market, but most experts say it is not actually collapsing. And there's definitely some debate about what is causing the current instability. I think at the beginning of the year, if you asked people, they would say, no, it is not collapsing. And more health insurers have been pulling out or filing rate increases, in part because there's so much uncertainty about what's going to happen in the healthcare system over the next year. And, you know, just on top of that filing yesterday, Blue Cross Blue Shield in North Carolina today filed rates, and they said they're raising their rates more than 20%. But they blamed it in part on actions taken by the administration, basically threatening to withhold payments for subsidies that they've been getting over the last few years. So some will argue that the instability is being caused by the current political situation.
Well, remember that the basis of insurance is spreading the risk among a large pool of people. And it sounds like insurers are saying, wait, if you're not going to cover certain people, then we have to raise the price in order to pay. And so explain what the CBO found. First of all, how would 14 million people become uninsured by next year, or 24 million or 23 million after that? Where would the cuts be there?
Yeah, it's interesting. A lot of those cuts, the CBO says, are because there would no longer be the requirement that people own insurance. So people would just drop insurance if they thought it was too expensive. And in addition, there's a huge amount of people who would lose insurance because of cutbacks to Medicaid. Under Obamacare, Medicaid was expanded to adults who make slightly more than poverty income. And that's going to be frozen and then slowly rolled back over time as people fall off the rolls because they make a little bit more money, they would not be able to re-enter. So over time, those two things add up to about 23 million people fewer having insurance in 10 years than would otherwise.
Well, in addition, costs are expected to go up for things like maternity care, mental health, substance abuse services, maybe by thousands of dollars.
Yeah, it could. And this is where some of the complexity of the bill comes in. The bill allows states to get waivers to get out of the requirements under Obamacare that certain things have to be included in your insurance. So if you live in one of those waiver states and they do say you don't no longer have to cover maternity care or mental health or even prescription drugs, then insurance companies either won't include them and you have to pay cash, or you could potentially buy an insurance rider. But those riders tend to be really pricey because the only people who buy them are people who are likely to use them.
Okay. What else are you seeing? What jumps out at you from the CBO scoring?
Well, one of the things that I saw that was really compelling is that the people who are going to win under this bill, it suggests, are younger, healthier people, because the bill would lower the average insurance rates by making insurance policies less comprehensive and by being able to exclude in some places people who have higher healthcare costs. But the losers are the older people and those who are more sick, because their subsidies to buy insurance are going to go down, but their premiums are going to go up.
Yeah. What do you think is going to happen? The Senate, prior to this scoring, had said, people in the Senate, like Susan Collins of Maine, had said, well, we're just going to tear up the House plan and we're going to start over again. What do you think is going to happen now?
Well, this certainly didn't help the cause at all. The bill still says about as many people are going to be uninsured under this bill, and it reduced the amount of deficit reduction. So it wasn't particularly good news. The Senate has two groups actually working on a health care plan. One is sanctioned by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. It's a group of Republicans. They're working on a bill. But then there's this sort of extra separate group that Susan Collins is involved with. And it's a bipartisan group, and they're kind of all, both working in secret, so it's hard to really know what's going to come out of that. But they're definitely not using this House-passed American Health Care Act as their basis.
Well, quick question. Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price said in a statement yesterday, the CBO was wrong when they analyzed Obamacare's effect on cost and coverage, and they are wrong again. Is there some truth to that, or Democrats are saying, well, we were going to tweak it anyway?
There's some truth to it. The CBO thought a lot more people would buy insurance under the Obamacare exchanges and fewer would get it under Medicaid expansion. But what they got right was how many more people would have insurance under Obamacare.
That's NPR health policy correspondent Allison Kojak. Allison, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, medical researchers have made a lot of progress developing artificial versions of organs like the heart, the lungs, and the kidneys. But they've been stumped by artificial blood. Blood is especially hard to recreate because it does so many things, from carrying oxygen to helping the immune system to heating and cooling the body. Well, now some Missouri researchers have taken a big step forward in creating artificial blood. Alex Smith from Here and Now contributor KCUR reports.
It's still dark when 70-year-old Johnny Matz arrives to make his regular donation at the Community Blood Center in Kansas City.
Get her done, brother. Just honestly, yeah, I start my day out like this.
Matz has been donating blood, plasma, or platelets for 45 years and now does it every other Friday morning. He's a retired railroad worker and says the early morning tradition began as a way to cap off a night shift.
When I very first started, I worked midnight to 8 o'clock. And so I came up here after I got off work.
Matz says he got into donating in part through his dad, who's now 92 and also still a regular donor.
So that's a huge inspiration to me. And then the Bible, you know, it says, love your neighbor as yourself. And this is one way I'm trying to love my neighbor back.
Keeping blood banks well-stocked takes the help of lots of donors like Matz because blood has a short shelf life and is always in demand. And donated blood isn't easy to work with. It has to be kept cool and matched for type. About a generation ago, researchers thought they were closing in on creating a substitute for donated blood.
I would say a lot of the different products that have been introduced over the years have had a lot of promise.
University of Kansas hospital surgeon Michael Moncure was involved in trials for a blood substitute that was introduced in the 80s and was made using hemoglobin, the part of the blood that carries oxygen. In several different versions, hemoglobin molecules were linked so they wouldn't fall apart in the body. Hopes were high. Then came the clinical trials.
The last blood substitute that we utilized in a trial that looked like it had the most promise actually showed that there was a higher level or rate of heart attacks that were associated with that.
It turned out that hemoglobin outside of a blood cell doesn't play nicely with the rest of the body. Some patients using this blood substitute had heart attacks or strokes or big spikes in blood pressure. In 2008, the National Institutes of Health released a study laying out the dangers of artificial blood. John Olson, a biochemist at Rice University, said that made a lot of researchers and investors jump ship.
Sadly, a lot of companies went out of business in 2008.
Since then, research has shown that real donated blood may have a shorter safe shelf life than originally thought. Rice says those findings have made many researchers rethink the possibilities of artificial blood.
So over the last few years, people have gone back to relook at this.
Among the new breed of researchers is Dr. Doctor.
My name is Alan Doctor. I'm a pediatric intensivist here at Children's Hospital in St. Louis and at Washington University in St. Louis.
Doctor's been working on a blood substitute called erythromure. It starts with hemoglobin molecules but covers them in a synthetic coating. Doctor says putting a coating on these tiny molecules is a painstaking process.
Right now, we're really in the sort of the craft beer stage where it's lovingly made by graduate students in a research laboratory.
The substance is a powder, not a liquid, to make it easier for use in the field. The U.S. Army is probably the biggest potential customer for artificial blood, and erythromure is especially suited for use in battlefields. The powder can be carried in someone's pocket and doesn't have to be kept cool.
And when we want to reconstitute it and use it, literally, you'd just add water. You add water and shake it, and boom, it's ready for injection.
doctor recently presented his work at the annual meeting of the American Society of Hematology. It's been used successfully in rats and mice, but is still in early stages of testing. John Olson believes that the synthetic coating on hemoglobin has the potential to avoid the problems of previous versions of artificial blood.
A lot more work needs to be done, but it's an interesting new idea.
Erythromere would probably only be a temporary fix, something to use until a patient can get donated blood. And it just carries oxygen, none of the other things that blood does. Olson says that an actual replacement for donated blood probably won't be manufactured from scratch in the laboratory. Instead, it will be grown using stem cells.
Yeah, nice little vein here.
Back at the Community Blood Center, Johnny Matz settles in for an hour and a half platelet donation session. Because even after decades of work, a true replacement for donated blood is still a long way off. And it's the generosity of donors like Matz that's needed to continue saving lives. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Smith.
Our next guest was the head of the CIA under President Obama. He was also defense secretary and was the White House chief of staff under President Clinton. He's currently chairman of the Panetta Institute for Public Policy in Monterey, California. Leon Panetta, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Nice to be with you, Jeremy.
And let's start with what we just saw, the bombing in Manchester, England, which killed 22 people earlier this week. We now know the bomber was a British national of Libyan descent who was already known to authorities. Is there any way to stop these homegrown terrorists?
Well, it's a real challenge to try to get ahead of these kinds of attacks. I mean, this is not a situation where you have a group of people planning some kind of coordinated attack similar to 9/11. What you have are individuals who are within a country, born and raised there often, living within a community, and suddenly for a lot of reasons, become self-radicalized. This is, in some ways it was termed the lone wolf type attack, where someone suddenly comes out of the wall and conducts a suicide attack that creates terror among innocent people. And we're seeing more of that, obviously, in these last few years, and that's the way ISIS operates. But it is very challenging to try to be able to stop those type of attacks.
Well, the fact that this bomber was known to authorities makes you wonder whether there needs to be more targeted surveillance of people who are suspected of having terrorist ties or doing suspicious things.
Well, again, I always think that law enforcement and intelligence agencies do try to develop lists of suspicious people that they need to track. But, I think, as always, how you put people on that list, what do you use to justify it, and then how many are going to be on that list, and do you have the resources to be able to track all of the people that may be suspicious, this is not an easy challenge.
I want to ask you about something else that happened this week. This is former CIA Chief John Brennan testifying before a House Intelligence Committee hearing on Tuesday.
I encountered and am aware of information and intelligence that revealed contacts and interactions between Russian officials and U.S. persons involved in the Trump campaign that I was concerned about because of known Russian efforts to suborn such individuals. And it raised questions in my mind, again, whether or not the Russians were able to gain the cooperation of those individuals.
Now, he went on to say he doesn't know if there was collusion between anyone in the Trump campaign and the Russians. But what did you make of that?
I think it further justifies the investigations that are going on into what Russia did and whether or not there is any collusion. I mean, the reality is that Russia conducted, a cyber attack on this country, a very serious attack to destabilize this country and interfere with our election process. In the process of doing that, they may very well have worked either wittingly or unwittingly with individuals in the Trump campaign. The reality is John Brennan testified that there were a number of individuals within the campaign that had contacts with the Russians. All of that has to be looked at. All of that has to be investigated to determine just exactly what took place here. This is a very serious issue because the Russians have not only conducted that kind of attack against the United States, they did it in France, they're doing it in Germany, they're doing it elsewhere. I think they've determined that this is a very viable weapon to use to create instability in a country. And because of that, we are obligated to do everything necessary to find out what exactly happened.
And are you confident now that that will happen with the appointment of Robert Mueller as special counsel?
I have a great deal of confidence in Bob Mueller. I worked with him when he was FBI director. I was CIA director. We had a great partnership. He's very serious. He's got a great deal of integrity. He focuses on the challenge that he's responsible for. I have a lot of confidence in his ability to conduct this investigation. He's a good man. In addition to that, I hope that the various committees that are investigating this on the Hill will continue to pursue this issue as well. This is extremely important. This country cannot afford to ignore what took place when a foreign adversary used this kind of attack on our country to go after our basic institutions, the institutions of our freedoms and our ability to conduct a free election, and to try to influence that and to try to undermine stability. And frankly, they're achieving their mission, what we're going through right now, in terms of how the Russians look at this country and the kind of turmoil we're going through right now. I'm sure in some ways they are looking at each other and saying, we've accomplished the mission that we were after, which was to very seriously destabilize the United States of America and create this kind of turmoil. We've got to make sure that doesn't happen in the future.
Well, so what did you make of President Trump hosting the Russian foreign minister and the Russian ambassador in the Oval Office and then, as we now know, revealing some very classified information to them?
Well, it raises serious concerns about just exactly whether or not the president really does understand the implications of what he's doing in this situation. I mean, the fact is Russians and the Russian nation is a foreign adversary of the United States. That's been the case for a long time. Their goal is to do everything possible to destabilize our country and to weaken the United States. The President of the United States needs to understand that. And yet, at times, in the way he behaves and what he says about the Russians and about the Russian threat and the fact that he was willing to share with them classified information that was very sensitive and that jeopardized not only the source of that intelligence but the relationship with the country that provided it, that is irresponsible. So it is very important, it seems to me, that if this country is to protect our national security, and very frankly, that is the first mission of the President of the United States, is to protect our country. He cannot afford to take this kind of attitude with regards to our foreign adversaries. He speaks strongly about ISIS. He speaks strongly about terrorists. He speaks strongly about Al-Qaeda, about Iran, about North Korea. He's got to wake up and speak strongly about the threat from Russia.
I want to ask you about one more big foreign policy issue, and maybe we'll put your defense secretary hat on here. The Trump administration is weighing whether or not to send potentially thousands more troops into Afghanistan. What do you think about that? Are you worried that we're getting bogged down there, or is it necessary to send more troops to have a surge to really take back control?
Nobody wants Afghanistan to fail and to become a safe haven for Al-Qaeda the way they did before 9/11. Nobody wants that. But at the same time, our tactics have not always been that successful in going after the Taliban and going after those terrorist threats that exist there. And in many ways, I think the only way we ought to add additional personnel is if we have reconsidered the fundamental strategy about how we approach this. We cannot allow the Afghanistanis to simply sit back. They've got to go after these various areas that are now in Taliban control. And there's got to be a larger strategy that focuses on how we achieve those goals and what kind of timetable do we set to achieve those goals rather than simply continuing to do what we're doing now. Something has got to change if we're going to be able to be successful there.
Do you think President Trump will serve out his full term in office?
Well, that's the question in everybody's mind right now. This has obviously been a hell of a ride these last 4 months. And, I've often said that this presidency is kind of the tale of two presidencies. On the national security side, I think he's got a pretty strong team. They provide pretty good views about our foreign policy and our national security policy. And the president seems to listen to them. On this trip, he's following the talking points. He seems to be adhering to a much more traditional approach to foreign policy abroad. On the domestic side and dealing with both the politics and domestic issues, I just don't get the sense that he has that kind of team. People that are experienced, people that know the Hill, people that know issues, people that know how to discipline how they operate in the White House. And the result is, the White House appears very chaotic. I don't think he can afford to continue to operate that way and be able to survive in office. He's going to have to restructure the way the White House operates.
That's Leon Panetta, former director of the CIA, former secretary of defense, now chairman of the Panetta Institute for Public Policy. Secretary Panetta, thanks so much, as always, for joining us.
Thanks. Nice to be with you, Jeremy.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
In the NBA playoffs, the Cleveland Cavaliers can book a berth in the finals with a win tonight in Boston, although some of us screaming in the rafters will try to fend that off. Okay, let's face it. The Cavs lead the Eastern Conference Championship Series 3-1, and they have the basket-stuffing LeBron James. Perhaps you've heard of him. The Celtics have the short in stature, huge in heart Isaiah Thomas. Maybe you don't know him, but you should. He played through the death of a sister, but now he's out with an injury. The winner of this series will take on the Golden State Warriors in the finals. They're having their toenails done, resting after sweeping the San Antonio Spurs in the Western Conference Finals 4-0. Mike Pesca is here, now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast at justitslate.com. Perhaps they're not having their nails done, but they are resting.
Perhaps they are. A good pedicure can add a half an inch to vertical leap, I hear.
But to this game tonight first, Boston and Cleveland. Do you think the Celtics can force a game six without Isaiah Thomas?
Well, without Isaiah Thomas, they did win 2 games ago. Now, perhaps that was because in game two, the game prior to the one Celtics win in the series, the Cavaliers won by 44. So you could argue maybe the Cavaliers didn't quite have the eye of the tiger, up 2-0, resting on this 44-point win. It'll be very, very hard. Yeah. Las Vegas says the Cavaliers are a 10-point favorite. I've seen some others suggesting, ESPN has a statistical model saying that they actually expect the Celtics to win, but I tend to doubt it, and I very much tend to doubt that they'll be able to come back and win the series.
Well, but if Cleveland and Golden State do meet in the finals, this is going to be the third straight year the championship has come down to that matchup. Is that good for the NBA?
That is good. That is good, especially because Cleveland beat the super team, the record-setting Warriors team, most games won in a regular season last year, in perhaps the most exciting NBA Finals in history. Mm-hmm. And this year, the Warriors have assembled what some call the greatest collection of talent ever assembled in the NBA. So the only thing in their way are these Cleveland Cavaliers. The Warriors have not lost in the playoffs. That hasn't happened ever, a team going into the finals with 12 straight wins. Maybe if the Cavaliers win tonight, they will go with only one loss. And that will be a setup and a matchup between juggernauts. That part, I think, is good. But other things going on in the NBA just below those two teams might not be as good.
We'll talk about that. Are you talking about the playoffs?
Yes, I think they've been boring. There have only been two series that have gone to a Game 7, a decisive Game 7, and one of those was an exciting Washington against Boston Celtics. Mm-hmm. But then the Jazz and Clippers went to Game 7, and that had all the hallmarks of, great, these two teams slugging it out for the right to be defeated in the next round by the team that will inevitably be defeated by the Warriors. So coming in, there was this sense, can anyone beat these two teams, the Cavs and the Warriors? The answer is... Once the Celtics did, but it doesn't seem the answer is yet. Yes, and I don't think that is good for the NBA. Their ratings would beg to differ. They haven't been great, but they haven't been off by that much. By some measures, they're up. By some measures, they're down. The just completed series between the Spurs and the Warriors was one of the lowest rated Western Conference finals, but they do say it was better rated than the Eastern Conference finals last year. But that is because Toronto was in that series, and that is not a rated market. So I think the NBA would like to have some other teams who could vie for the championship.
Okay. Well, Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst, he hosts the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com, says probably the Celtics can't win tonight. Let's see. Mike, thank you.
All right. I'll bet you a pedicure on it.
In Manchester, England, police say they have evidence the suicide bomber who killed 22 people was part of a larger network. They've arrested two more people today for a total of eight. The investigation is also extended to Libya. The British Home Secretary said the bomber, Salman Abedi, recently returned from a visit to Libya. Abedi's father and brother have also been detained by authorities in Libya. Joining us now via Skype is Chris Stephen, who is Libya correspondent for The Guardian. Chris, first of all, were you at all surprised that the suspect had connections to Libya?
No, I wasn't. And I think a lot of the Libyan community in Britain were also not that surprised. Libya is, as you know, the main base for Islamic State in North Africa. And although they've been dealt a series of hammer blows, they remain in being and training terrorists, indeed the terrorists who attacked the Sousse resort in Tunisia in 2005 were trained there. So, no, I think it's, you know, ISIS is a big concern in Libya.
And when we hear about security forces arresting some of the family members of the suicide bomber, who are those security forces and who asks them to do that?
Well, in Tripoli, the security forces are more or less militias. Some are better organized than others. The one doing the arrest is called RADA, and it's probably the most organized militia, perhaps the nearest thing that the city has to a police force. But the problem is they're all self-governing. I mean, they run their own show. They don't really take orders from the government. And, of course, the militias all fight each other. So the arrests that they've carried out are by people who are opposed to the militias that the other people support. So there's a risk in these arrests that it may trigger a new round of militia violence.
Well, and remind us of the political situation in Libya. There's an interim government in Tripoli that was formed under a UN peace deal, but how much control does that government actually have?
Yes, the interim government has actually very little control. It was formed, as you say, by a UN commission, but it wasn't elected, so it doesn't really have public support. It's in Tripoli, but it relies on militias for security, and it's opposed by another government in Tobruk. And so there's a rather confusing civil war going on, and the net result of the civil war is chaos, and that's why the country's a funnel for migrants, and it also allows ISIS to operate as it wants.
And are the ISIS fighters in Libya mostly native Libyans, or are they coming in from outside?
The ISIS are a mix. There are some Libyans. They've not had much success, actually, in getting mass support in what is a tribal society. But ISIS do get a lot of foreign fighters coming in from all over Africa, and it's become a sort of training center for them.
When you go into Libya, when you're in Tripoli, when you're in other places in Libya, is it safe for you to be there?
It's actually very unsafe, and I haven't been in Tripoli for a while, and most reporters don't go back there anymore. The embassies all pulled out 2 years ago when the civil war got started, because there's, in addition to the civil war, there are militias fighting one another for territory, for money. Kidnapping is endemic, and it's becoming a sort of failed state.
Well, and we're also hearing about more of these boats of migrants leaving Libya, and in many cases, people drowning. There was an incident this week where more than 30 children and adults drowned trying to leave Libya. What's the refugee situation at this point?
Well, the refugee situation, the migrant situation is dire, particularly after the European Union made a deal with Turkey to stem migrants moving from Turkey to EU. The main route to the EU is now through Libya and then across the Mediterranean, and migrants come from all over Africa and Asia and are funneled through Libya by gangs. And these gangs are quite cynical in how the sort of boats that they put these people to sea in. And as you say, you know, hundreds, thousands, I think, have drowned this year already.
So what do you see as the future of Libya? Is anything going to bring stability to the country?
Well, the United Nations is trying to get this government more widely accepted, but it's sort of not getting anywhere. There is a civil war going on. I think that it's a very difficult situation. You have two governments, you have all these militias. You don't have any force or any political party that everyone can coalesce around. And I think this chaos is likely to go on. And I think while the chaos goes on, I think ISIS will have freedom of movement.
And is any country on the outside, whether it be a European country or the United States, likely to step in again after what happened in the removal of Gaddafi?
Well, yeah, outside countries are very reluctant to step in. As you say, they stepped in to basically win the 2011 Arab Spring Revolution, but they don't really want to step in again, the exception being combating ISIS. The head of AFRICOM, the U.S. Africa Command, was in Tripoli on Tuesday to discuss with militia leaders and the U.N. government how to battle ISIS. And I think if there is a stepping in, I think it will come because of if it escalates or if it becomes a bigger problem than it is now.
That's Chris Stephen, Libya correspondent for The Guardian. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, there are fewer than 20,000 people of Libyan descent living in the United States, and one of them has taken on a mission that's changed his life and the lives of many others. Erica Lance of Here and Now contributor WBUR has the story of Mohammed Bazik.
I didn't really tell many people about this story, you know. I mean, for a long time, I didn't talk about it.
Mohammed Bazik is a 62-year-old retired engineer who lives in Azusa, California. He says he will always remember the day he met the boy with long eyelashes.
He has long lashes, dark lashes, and even the nurses envy him.
The boy with long lashes couldn't hear. He couldn't see. He couldn't move his body or properly regulate his temperature. The baby boy was born with birth defects and a skull full of fluid, and, as far as Muhammad knows, was abandoned by his mother. Muhammad met the foster boy while he was still in the hospital.
The minute I saw him, I fall in love with this kid. Unbelievable. I mean, it's like I know him for a long time.
As he'd done with so many other children, Muhammad took the boy home with him. We can't use the boy's name because he was in foster care. Muhammad is the only person in Los Angeles County who exclusively takes in children with terminal illnesses. Muhammad used to live in Libya, and he came to the U.S. to study engineering. He met his wife here, and together they learned of the dire need for people to take in children who are dying, kids whose parents just can't handle it. Caring for children with complex medical needs is hard, but losing them is harder.
10 children die in my house, and most of them I was holding them in my arms, you know.
Muhammad and his wife had fostered dozens of children when, in 1997, they had their own biological son. Here they'd been sharing their home with kids who needed constant supervision and care. And then their son Adam was born with dwarfism and brittle bone disease.
When he born, he has 8 skull fraction, broken jaws, broken legs and arms.
Adam is 19 now and weighs 65 pounds. He can't stand, but he gets around on a device Muhammad made from an ironing board and roller skate wheels. At school, it was dangerous for Adam to play with other kids. But there was one person Adam did get close to, his blind and deaf foster brother. They were an unlikely pair. Adam was unusually small and couldn't be touched. His foster brother was unusually tall, and touch was his only way to communicate.
Because Adam's so small, Adam, he used to crawl over him lay down on his chest and give him a hug.
Every night, when it was time for the boy's bedtime medicine, Adam would turn on music, and Muhammad would pick up his foster son and dance with him. But as with his other children, the happy times couldn't last. The boy was 6 when doctors told Muhammad he didn't have long to live, and it would be fine to leave him at the hospital.
I said, no, I never let him in the hospital. I've been taking care of him since he was a baby, and this is time he needs me more than before.
2 months later, the boy with long lashes died.
We visit him, you know. I visit my kids, still visiting my kids in the cemetery. I go, me and Adam, and there are 8 of them in the same cemetery.
In the years since that loss, Muhammad's wife died, so now he has to care for Adam and foster children by himself, leaving the house only when a nurse can cover for him. It's grueling work that almost seems crazy, but for Muhammad, it's the most important thing he can do to give his life meaning.
There's a lot of people that say, why are you taking kids dying? Why? I said, if you don't take them, nobody want to take them. The world have forgotten about them. As a human being, I need to help somebody who needs my help.
Muhammad says he'll keep helping them, one by one, for as long as he can. For Here and Now, I'm Erica Lance.
Listen to this sound caught on surveillance cameras. It's chilling, but what forensics experts hear is the gunshots, a shotgun, then a pistol. What can they learn? With the increased use of cameras and cell phones, acoustic forensics is an evolving field. Leading it, Robert Maher, an expert in gunshots, also a professor of electrical and computer engineering at Montana State University. He joins us from Bozeman. Professor Maher, welcome.
Good afternoon.
I want to start with a fascinating case out of Cincinnati, Ohio. 2 shots are fired. 1 man was killed. Another is injured. The injured man claimed that he was firing in self-defense. In other words, the dead man had fired first. There were eyewitnesses, but the shots were so close together, people really didn't know. You found out what?
In that particular case, it happened that down the street from where this incident occurred, there was a residence that had several home security cameras mounted around the house, and the homeowner also had the sound recorded at each of those locations. And so although the cameras were not positioned in such a way to see the incident, the microphones were able to pick up the sound of the gunfire.
And what did that sound, what did those, you know, audio waves tell you?
In this particular case, the sounds were recorded along with not only the bang of the gun, which we call the muzzle blast, but also the echoes of that sound off the ground, nearby buildings, and surrounding surfaces. And so my interpretation of the evidence was that the gunshot sounds of 2 similar handguns, there was a difference between the sound that was recorded from those 2 guns and the reflection that was very apparent in one of the recordings was attributable to that gun pointing down the block toward a large building at the end of the street, which then caused a very distinct echo to be picked up in the recording. The firearm, which was pointing the other direction, held by the other individual, had a quieter sound in the reverse direction. And so the difference in this echo pattern of these 2 closely spaced firearms led to the conclusion that the first shooter was pointed in the north direction, and combined with the other evidence and eyewitnesses, that led to a conclusion about who shot first.
Wow, that it was the wounded man who said he fired second in self-defense who actually fired first. What are some of the other things that you can tell from looking at the sound wave of a bullet? Can you know exactly what kind of a gun is used if you see the wave?
We've done special recordings that we do here at a shooting range where we're using precision microphones, and we elevate the shooting position and the microphones off the ground so we can get what is called an anechoic recording or no echo recording that is just the sound of the gun without any of the characteristic reflections. And we do see noticeable and regular differences between different types of firearms and different ammunition in those firearms. And the question that we're still researching is how much of that detail is going to be present in what is likely to be a less reliable recording from a, you know, voice recorder or a cell phone or some other device that isn't as carefully prepared as we do in our experimental tests.
Yeah. You know, if this is going to be going to court, if this is going to say to an injured man, actually, you shot first, you know, which certainly might change his future, what do you worry about getting wrong?
Well, I think in any kind of forensic science, there is a need to remember that forensic experts are not in court to be an advocate of a particular conclusion about the guilt or innocence of a person involved. The experts are there to explain the science and what is scientifically possible as best as we can, and to give the court some education about how these things are interpreted and how the evidence fits together from a variety of sources. So part of my involvement and part of my work as a researcher is to do as much as I can to try to make this a more scientific and objective field of study.
And we understand that you became interested in this when a lawyer friend, a defense attorney, was asking you one of those who shot first questions that we talked about earlier, but it had to do with an emergency call center recording. What happened there?
In these cases, and this was probably a little over 10 years ago, the question was whether it was possible from a recorded telephone call in which a gunshot was heard in the background, whether it was possible to identify the very specific firearm that made that sound, down mm-hmm. to the serial number. And my initial reaction at that time was, well, I certainly don't think that's possible. And it was only later when I got off the phone, I started wondering, well, I really, you know, don't know scientifically what might be possible. And that is one of the things that led me to start getting involved in this kind of research.
That's Robert Maher, professor of electrical and computer engineering at Montana State University, but also an expert in the growing field of audio forensics. And he specifically studies gunshot sounds. Well, Professor, it's chilling, of course, because we're talking about bullets and often, you know, used in crime, but also fascinating. So thank you so much.
It was a pleasure to talk to you, Robin. Thanks.
And by the way, to the original question, Professor Maher discovered it's not possible to distinguish which gun is firing down to a serial number yet. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.